Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Quine. I'm the club's president and the national correspondent for Media General Newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind you of some upcoming events. On Tuesday, July 12th, Timothy Wirth, Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs, will help us present the National Press Club Robert L. Kozik Environmental Reporting Awards and discuss U.S. global commitments to environmental protection. On Wednesday, July 13th, Bud Selig, Chairman of the National League Baseball Executive Committee, will discuss the pending strike. And on Thursday, July 14th, Madeleine Albright, the permanent U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations, will be on hand to present the National Press Club's Edwin M. Hood Award for Diplomatic Correspondence. Audio and video tapes, as well as transcripts of Press Club luncheons, are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards available for you at your tables and pass them up, and I will ask as many as time permits. I will now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Gary Arnold, senior movie critic for the Washington Times. Barbara Gamarikian, a freelance journalist. Alan Emery, Washington correspondent for the Watertown New York Daily Times. Sandra McElwain, a freelance journalist. Peggy Roberson, national desk editor of Hearst Newspapers. Eleanor Clift, deputy bureau chief and White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Jack Valenti, president and chief executive officer of the Motion Picture Association of America. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, we have Mary Crowley, executive editor of Business Publishers Incorporated and the vice chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Barbara Harris, president of the National Capital Resources and the member of the club's committee who arranged today's luncheon. Milton Jakes, president of the National Speakers Bureau. Mary Otto, the national correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. And finally, Jacobo Goldstein of CNN Radio. What? Who did I miss? Cheryl Fields. I'm sorry about that. Here it is. Cheryl Fields, Associate Managing Editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education. I've got to get a better way. That's the third time I've done that this year. My apologies. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, today we are pleased to have with us the man with the million-dollar dimple, Mr. Kirk Douglas, the actor, author, and producer who has been described as a guy's guy's guy. Mr. Douglas is here today to talk about what he sees as the merging of fantasy and reality, not only in movies, but also in the news media. We've had some examples lately, especially in the O.J. Simpson debacle, where life imitates art and the image of the hero smacks right into reality. A Hollywood legend for nearly 50 years, Mr. Douglas's roles are as old as the 1949 boxing classic Champion, as enduring as the 1957 gunfight at the O.K. Corral, and of course, the 1960 Spartacus, and as recent as this year's comedy, Greedy, in which he plays a rich and cunning uncle who manipulates his groveling nieces and nephews. And Mr. Valenti tells me that within 9 days, he's starting another movie, which I think puts him over 80 in all. Some of his memorable films some of his most memorable films he has made with his friend and fellow Hollywood legend, Burt Lancaster. Last night, I watched the 1986 Tough Guys. And I'll tell you, it's worth the price of admission just to see Mr. Douglas jump rope to attract the attention of a young lady. And maybe we can have a demonstration of that during the question and answer period. In the highest form of flattery, his urgent voice, clenched teeth, tough guy role has been imitated and parodied by generations of comedians. But Mr. Douglas's life has been more than just movies. His autobiography, The Ragman's Son, came out to such critical acclaim that he soon followed it with two novels, Dance with the Devil and The Gift, and a third one, Last Tango in Brooklyn, is due out tomorrow. Born Isser Danielovich, literally as the Ragman's son in Amsterdam, New York, Mr. Douglas made his way through St. Lawrence University on a wrestling scholarship and worked as a janitor to meet expenses. His acting career began on Broadway as a singing Western Union boy, but it was Lauren Bacall who in 1946 recommended to movie producer Hal Wallace that the young Broadway actor should be cast opposite Barbara Stanwyck in The Strange Love of Martha Ivers. The rest, as they say, is history. Perhaps the best accolade for Mr. Douglas was provided by his son Michael, who once said of his father, "His discipline and stamina are inspirational. He grabs life and he eats it up." Would that every father had a son who could say such for him. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm Press Club welcome for Mr. Kirk Douglas.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, Mr. President, you talk about people doing imitations of me. It's always fascinated me. And I remember once I was at home watching television and I saw Frank Gorshin, who does wonderful imitations. And Frank Gorshin was doing an imitation of me on television. And as I watched, I tried to go along with him and do the imitation as he was doing it. And as I did that, my son tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Dad, Frank Gorshin can do you better than you." But I want you to know that I was especially pleased to receive this invitation to come here today because I'm right at the point of changing careers. And what better venue to make this announcement than the National Press Club? Yes, after making 81 movies and after writing 4 books, I feel I have honed my acting and writing skills sufficiently to become a news reporter. Hey. That's all right. You scoff. But these days, when movies are becoming more realistic, Philadelphia, Schindler's List, and the news media are relying more on dramatizations, I should fit in very well. Please consider my qualifications. And by the way, those of you who might want to hire me, please don't feel free to write notes. My resume? I was born on... Now, before I give you my birthday, let me warn you that age discrimination is illegal. December the 9th, 1916. My parents, illiterate immigrants from Russia, worked hard all their lives and never had a chance to learn to read and write. Perhaps this is why learning was always so important to me. See, since I was a kid, I loved to read. The public library was my favorite hangout. The written word inspired all my dreams. But I didn't realize just then how important the written word can be. So when I had to write an essay on what is more important, the sword or the pen, I said, "The sword, of course." And later on in years, I made a lot of movies to prove it. I made The Vikings, Spartacus, Paths of Glory, Gunfight at the OK Corral, all a tribute to the sword. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I should tell you first about my education. Isn't that what comes next on a resume? I attended St. Lawrence University. I tried out for the wrestling team, and I became an undefeated wrestler. Now, that's a useful skill for a reporter, no? Yeah, with all the pushing and shoving you go through. To pay my college tuition, I wrestled in carnivals during summer vacations. Now, the barker would introduce the star attraction. Ladies and gentlemen, the masked marvel, who among you has the courage to step up and challenge my million-dollar horse? Now, I was the guy planted in the audience. Ah, gentleman who isn't afraid to risk his life, step right up, step right up. Then I'd put on a pair of tights and stand opposite my big opponent. The crowd cheered for me, the underdog. They rushed to buy tickets. We wrestled furiously for about 10 minutes. We'd done it before. The mass marvel was my college buddy on the college wrestling team. But I always won, and I made it look convincing. Now let's see, after graduation, I went to New York City to attend a dramatic school and then on to Broadway. An all-star cast of Chekhov's Three Sisters, Catherine Cornell, Judith Anderson, Ruth Gordon, and they offered me a part. I was ecstatic. See, the scene was so romantic. This young Russian soldier in a white tunic says goodbye to the forest around his house before going to war. And he calls out, "Yo-ho!" And off stage, the trees echo back, "Yo-ho!" I was the offstage echo. But before my career could get any worse, the war interfered. So the next item on my resume, military service, that's World War II, not World War I. I wanted to fight, so they sent me to a midshipman school at Notre Dame. And what a waste of taxpayers' money. They tried to teach me how to recognize airplanes as they flash silhouettes on the screen. And I tell you, I feel for those poor guys who made that terrible mistake over Iraq last April. See, while everybody in the class was calling out Zero, Spitfire, Messerschmitt, I sat there like a dummy. I couldn't tell a Messerschmitt from a Mercedes. But the Navy didn't mind. They made me an officer in charge of communications and anti-submarine warfare in the Pacific. Thanks to me, we almost blew up our own ship, and I ended up in the San Diego Naval Hospital. Well, what else can I impress you with? What comes next on a resume? Religion? Or aren't you allowed to ask that? Well, I'll give you a hint. I'm the same religion as Albert Einstein and Jesus. Sexual preference? Another taboo? And so it should be. You know, a lot of harm comes from sexual preference. You know, that reminds me. After I did Lust for Life, I played the homosexual artist Van Gogh. We had a special private screening, and John Wayne, an old friend of mine, was there, and he was furious. He motioned me to come over, and he said, "How can you play a part like that, a queer who commits suicide?" And I laughed. I thought he was joking. I said, "Come on, John. It's all make-believe." But he meant it. "No," he said, "tough guys like us have an obligation to keep that image for the public." See, he really thought he was John Wayne. But you know, by the way, some of you guys think you're John Wayne. Years ago, I was in Pakistan visiting the Afghanistan refugee camps. I remember a very well-known American anchorman reporting the news of the war on the border. Now, why couldn't he sit behind a desk and clearly and rationally tell us what was happening? No, no. He has to be in show business. He has to do his broadcast from the field, crouched behind a big boulder, peering up at the camera, clutching a microphone, gunfire in the background, boom, boom. Now, the only ones in danger were the cameraman and the sound man taking pictures of the anchorman hiding behind the rock. Such crap. Have I offended you?
Not yet.
Well, I don't know. I must have. I don't see any of you taking notes on my resume. The hell with it. You see, coming from the world of make-believe, I depend on news reporters to bring me into the world of reality. I resent it when they don't. But now, I know I'm more and more alarmed by the fuzziness. Everywhere I feel the world of make-believe creeping into the world of reality. Now, how would you like to be an American soldier, your face blackened, making a surprise night landing on a beach in Somalia, and be greeted by glaring television lights? Somalia? Sands of Iwo Jima? See, where the hell does reality end and make-believe begin? On the other side of primetime, do you ever see any of those police shows? Those are real policemen, but they're acting, and very well, too. They don't even notice the lights and camera in front of them as they crouch, guns at the ready, and rush around the corner into danger. Who needs actors when they have reality? And that's another reason why I'm making a career change. But the fault does not lie with television, movies, or any form of make-believe. You see, we are to blame as a society. You know, 2 weeks ago, the nation was mesmerized by the television pictures of O.J. Simpson driving along a deserted freeway, pointing a gun at his head. He was slowly followed by 8 police cars in formation. I watched. I know O.J. I was horrified. But on the parallel lanes, in the middle of rush hour traffic, all cars were stopped, horns blowing, people yelling, cheering, as if O.J. was racing down a football field. To them, was it make-believe, or was it reality? It was a tragedy. But we like our reality seasoned with make-believe. But that can be dangerous when it becomes a tool of self-deception. I remember visiting peaceful, charming Sarajevo during the Olympics. Years before, I remember making a movie in Yugoslavia and having lunch with President Tito in Ljubljana. It all seemed so blissful. I was naive. I thought it was a united country. I was not aware that civil war was seething underneath. But is there a civil war seething in our country? A civil war that pits Republicans versus Democrats being fought with a poison pen instead of a sword? And the party out of power resorts to make-believe to tear down the opposition? I think it's an evil game, insidious and underhanded. Oh, and Rush Limbaugh plays it well, yeah? His audience roar with laughter as this gleeful Pillsbury doughboy sits there. He sits there manufacturing insults and innuendos against our president. And imitating this orange juice salesman, Clinton haters on a search and destroy mission truck out a woman making old claims of sexual harassment. Now, at a time when we have explosions and implosions in South Africa, Somalia, Rwanda, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Yemen, Israel, and so many problems here in our own country, must the man, the president, forget these concerns and defend himself against a woman whose own family says she's living in a world of fantasy? You know, the whole escapade has given me an idea for my next novel. Now, how do you like this? Saddam Hussein gives $10 million to an Ames-like character in the CIA to find five women to institute suits of sexual harassment against the president. While the trial is on, he attacks Saudi Arabia. You know, it's too ridiculous, but so much of what happens these days is ridiculous. Have you heard about RINO? R-I-N-O, RINO? It's a new term coined by Republicans in Los Angeles to censor Mayor Reardon for having too many Democrats in his cabinet. You see, they call him RINO, Republican in name only. He was aiming to heal old wounds, bring together a city torn apart after the riots, but they think he's being disloyal to his party. That gave me no new ideas for a novel. You know, not long ago, I had a talk with my son, Michael. He gave me a pat on the back. And anyone who knows me knows how much I love to receive a pat on the back. Daddy said, you know, I admire what you've done for your country. I want to do something too. I said, good idea, Michael. Why don't you go into politics? He laughed at me. What's so funny? Sure, Dad, go into politics and have them criticize me for smoking pot when I was in college and bring up every love affair I had and every love affair I didn't have. No way. But isn't it sad? You see, no great man has ever led a life free of mistakes. And anyone who has just hasn't had the guts to take risks. There's something murky in every great man's past. But if they go into politics, it will be found out, distorted, and blown out of proportion. I think the people going into politics today are either fools or very courageous, especially with people like Rush Limbaugh or Jerry Falwell running loose. Is it no wonder that the president is outraged? Any decent sane person has to be. Reverend Jerry Falwell, invoking the name of God with the American flag unfurled behind him, is selling videotapes accusing the president of, and I quote, countless murders. Now, seriously, this is the worst venture of the radical right to damage the president. Now, Falwell admits that he has no evidence to support the claims, but he thunders from the pulpit of self-righteousness that he feels a moral obligation to disseminate these unsubstantiated charges anyway. And by the way, he sells them for a $43 donation, tax deductible, shipping included. Now, one could dismiss this evil man, but what he is doing is too serious. He and his kind, while playing their scurrilous game, have appropriated God and country. To invoke the name of God or fly the flag today risks being identified with their ilk. You know, 40 years ago, I met a girl in Paris, beautiful girl. I brought her to the United States, and I married her. The first thing my wife Anne did was apply for citizenship. She studied every day, legislative, executive, judicial, and I laughed. It struck me funny. And she snapped at me. How do you know what it means to be an American? You are one. Yeah, it's easy to take for granted this unique place, settled by a diverse assembly of immigrants and forged into a society that holds brotherhood as an ideal. You know, dictatorships around the globe are crumbling, being replaced by democracies, so all eyes look to us to set an example. We owe it to the rest of the world, as well as ourselves, to improve what we have and make it stronger. We must become nicer people who care for others. Those that have more should help those that have less. It may take a long time, but let's keep moving in that direction. In a few days, we will celebrate the birth of our independence, 4th of July. Let's risk being politically incorrect and allow ourselves to love our country. Let's take God and the flag away from those who use them as weapons of hate. Let's dare to be naive and recapture the feeling we used to have on that day when we were children. Come on and take a walk with me through this green and growing land. Walk through the meadows and the mountains and the sand. Walk through the valleys and the rivers and the plains. Walk through the sun and walk through the rain. Even an anti-establishment rebel like Phil Oakes felt it when he wrote that. Yet she's only as rich as the poorest of the poor, only as free as the padlocked prison door, only as strong as our love for this land, only as tall as we stand. Here is a land full of power and glory, beauty that words cannot recall. Oh, her power shall rest on the strength of her freedom. Her glory shall rest on us all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Douglas. I encourage you all now to pass your questions up. The first one is, are you saying that the media should ignore things like Paula Jones's allegations, or that is it possible for even the media to ignore charges made out there?
Why are you stumbling and asking me that question?
Because I'm trying to phrase it.
Because it's a very simple question. Of course, the media must report the news.
Right.
They must not go into show business. They must not say, this is a hot item. Let's milk this. They must rationally report the news.
The New York Times and the Washington Post today reported that the British were outraged by Prince Charles's admission in a TV news show to infidelity, not because he had been unfaithful to his wife, but because he admitted it to the general public. What is your reaction to that?
Mr. President,
yes.
If you've read any of my books, you'll know that I'm of the opinion that every man has strayed, but I'm also of the opinion that that's not the most important thing about a man. That's what I said when I meant that in every great man's past, there might be something murky. It's the emphasis that is placed on that. Frankly, I don't care whether Prince Charles had an affair with someone else. I just hope if he becomes a king, he'll become a good man. I just think that what the media must do is change the emphasis of what the report. To me, that is not that important.
This questioner would like to know, does Congress have a right to regulate the violence in the movie and television business? Do you think that violence is a problem in this industry?
I have my friend Jack Valenti sitting here, and he's going to listen very carefully to what I have to say. Of course, Congress has no right to regulate anything like that in an artistic world. You have the right to regulate that. When Mr. Valenti instituted the code of telling what the picture's about, what is a regulating thing? It's for children. Grown-ups should be able to see whatever they want to see. Frankly, I think, like a lot of people object to the sexual nudity in pictures, that doesn't bother me. I think there is too much violence in films, and I think a lot of people deal with it, you know, in different ways. I just mentioned two great movies, Philadelphia and Schindler's List. But I do think violence is a problem, not only in movies, in our life. It's a problem the way the media concentrates on it. But it's something that we have to deal with. But the greater danger would be to have Congress regulating what we should see or read.
This questioner says, the Sunday New York Times Magazine cover story features media wags discussing the question of which came first, the news media's interest in the prurient or the public's interest in having the news media report it. What is your answer?
Well, that's like asking me what came first, the chicken or the egg. I don't know. I just think that this is something that we, in our field of make-believe, and you, in your field of the reality, have got to clarify a little bit more. We, in the field of make-believe, have to perhaps censor ourselves in how we make certain films. And you in the media perhaps have to be careful of what you emphasize, because an emphasis on something is a way of making an important statement.
To what extent do you think the entertainment industry fantasy is contributing to what's happening in the world of reality?
You know, I don't even know the answer to that. You know, we in the world of make-believe, in writing a novel or in making a movie, we reflect our society. Perhaps in some ways, we certainly have an influence on people, but I don't know. I wouldn't be able to answer that question. To what extent does what one see in a movie affect those that watch it? I don't know.
This questioner says, with respect to your comments towards Rush Limbaugh's radio show and his derogatory comments aimed at President Clinton, does not freedom of speech come into play? Because in a democracy, we have many voices, and all should be allowed freedom to express their ideas and opinions.
But I resent that someone like Rush Limbaugh has all his time and effort to heap all of these crazy things. You know, taking a piece of film, what we call stop a film. You hold that. Now, that's the film you see. Now, the guy could say all kinds of crazy things that'll make you laugh. I mean, it's unfair because you're talking about the President of the United States. Of course, we should be allowed to criticize. But how about people in the media taking an opposite position? Isn't there anybody that disagrees with Rush Limbaugh? Then I think they should express themselves. Then at least you'd have a balance.
When the Senate puts on an Anita Hill on and the whole country stops to watch, does it matter what us writing wretches do in the reporting the news?
Repeat that question.
Okay. When the Senate puts an Anita Hill on television and the whole country stops to watch, does it matter what us reporting wretches do in writing wretches do in reporting the news? Well, that's a tongue twister.
Well, you know, that was a very important moment. Of course, no matter what side you take in the Anita Hill position, no matter what side, for her, against her, it was important. It was dealing with an important issue, and it brought our attention to an important issue. And I thought that was very meaningful. Then all you want from the media is to report both sides, if you will, fairly. And then an individual has a chance to make his decision.
This questioner says the administration, Clinton administration, is orchestrating an attack on the religious right. Do you consider your speech and appearance today as part of that? Hey, I just asked the question.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry I criticized Reverend Falwell. I wish there was an attack. I'm an American. My parents, I've told you, couldn't read or write. Nobody appreciates the value that this country, the value that it means to me, the chance that it has given me. My parents couldn't read or write, and I've had a college education. But I resent a faction coming in like the so-called religious right. I resent them usurping as if they are the only ones who can speak of God and the American flag. That's what I resent. They have a right to express their opinion.
Do you think violence in film and TV is distorting children's view of reality?
Yes. I definitely do. I think that is a problem. And I think the power of our film world, especially the American cinema, which is so important all over the world. You know, in other countries, the government subsidizes the film industry. In our country, the film industry makes millions, possibly billions of dollars. But that's beside the point. I do think that that's a problem, and I don't know the solution. Violence for kids to see, too much violence, is a problem.
Do you feel the media picks and chooses for us whose freedom of speech we are going to hear?
Well, you know, I feel my only criticism with the media, hey, I read three papers a day. To me, the news is important. I feel that there's a danger, and I try to say that, of the media going into show business. What gets you the best ratings? See, I feel that going in that direction will take you away from just, you know, let's face it, in England years ago, they never had anchormen, they had newsreaders. They just reported the news. And I think there's a danger to get the right balance. I don't mind personalities, which I like all that. But I think the media has a problem to solve, just as we in the film world have a problem to solve. And that is to get the fair balance of how to report the news and we how to make movies that might ill affect children.
Jack Villani wanted me to ask you, who did write your speech?
Well, you have great speech writers in Washington, but the guy that wrote these words is the guy that wrote Last Tango in Brooklyn, a book that I wrote. You can get it at your local bookstore.
All of us with resumes in hand in this news business, we have targets where we want to get jobs. If you had a chance now, which one of these news media outlets are you going to apply to here?
Already I got an offer. I see it now. Nightly News with Kirk Douglas. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Kirk Douglas bringing you the Nightly News. No, I think I'll stick to my racket. I don't think I'll jump quite so soon. Thank you.
That's going to take some of the competition off the rest of us with our own resumes out. Was Ronald Reagan's presidency symbolic of America's desire to escape from reality?
Well, you said it, I didn't. Well, I tell you, it does show you, you see, in our profession, myself, we have an unfair advantage. You've asked me to come here and speak today because of maybe you know me in some movies and all that. It's an unfair advantage. And I have to take that seriously because that gives me a chance to express my views, which might be different from the views someone else wants to express that doesn't agree with me. But when you see, you say about President Reagan being elected president, it does show you that people in the public eye, whether it's in the news world or whether it's in movies, do have an impact on the public. The public gets to acknowledge them, and there is a power. And any power is dangerous because it can be used for good things or for bad things. That's the danger.
Of course, we have a few movie questions here, as you might expect. This question wants to know, how did you keep a straight face when Tony Curtis called you Spartacus in that heavy Brooklyn accent?
You see, now here is a great movie with Laurence Olivier, Charles Laughton, Peter Ustinov. And you know, he's right. Tony Curtis was miscast in that. But you see how the news media can take one infinitesimal thing and twist it.
Your performance in Paths of Glory was remarkable. Is that better?
I like it.
And yet, though the movie was an artistic masterpiece, it was not a financial success. Why does Hollywood pay so little attention to films that may not have a huge financial success potential?
Well, I disagree with that. I mean, The two movies that I pointed out, Philadelphia and Schindler's List, believe me, was not an easy movie to put up and spend all that money. That was not a subject that they thought would make a fortune. After all, movies are in the business of make-believe, and it's a business. They're there to make money. All in all, I am really amazed at how often we in our field will succeed in making a worthwhile movie. I mean, you know, whether it's Paths of Glory, Philadelphia, Schindler's List, we do try. It's difficult because people are putting in millions and millions of dollars and they want a return on their investment. So they go more for what the public want, some form of entertainment. But I think all in all, the American movie industry has dealt with important subjects in an honest way.
Who would you list as references on your resume? Why do you choose to list them?
I stand alone before you. I ask no help from anyone except my friend Jack Valenti, who can speak for me. No, I think the only reference any person can have is what he's done, his work. That should speak for the person.
This question would like to know, how long did it take Izzy Danielewicz to become Kirk Douglas? Can you tell us something about the metamorphosis?
Well, as a matter of fact, I rather like the name Izzy Danielewicz. If I had been a ballet dancer, I would have been Izzy Danielewicz. You see, it went through a period, you know, which doesn't exist now, even in movies. You got Schwarzenegger, you have Pacino, you have De Niro, you have ethnic names, and I think that's wonderful. I came in that period where everybody said, well, you had to have a name, Rock, Hudson, Tab, Hunter, Kirk Douglas, phony. But that was the trend at that time. But I think now there's much more honesty, and I like the fact that people do use their ethnic names. And if I was going to change my name again, I'd change it to Valenti.
although your career obviously is not over, this question would like to know, what would you like to be remembered for?
You know, that's a difficult question to ask a young man like me. But I think, you know, if I have to think of it quickly, I think, you know, you want to be remembered for a couple of movies that might have influenced some people. You want to be remembered maybe for a book or two that somebody enjoyed, took them out of their problems for a few hours. See, I think the world of entertainment is so essential because in this world of tension, we need something to forget all our problems, to get wrapped up in the problems or the excitement of some other people. So I'd like to be remembered as one person who played a part in that process.
Is it really true what you wrote about Nathan's hot dogs? I don't know. I hope that you would have some recognition on that.
As a matter of fact, I don't want to start giving endorsements for products, but when I was writing my book, Last Tango in Brooklyn, I spent a lot of time in Coney Island, and I spent a lot of time eating Nathan's hot dogs, and I must confess, they were delicious.
Tell us a little bit about the difference between the movie star and a writer. Have you, it's a whole different group of people who you're dealing with, is it not?
Well, it's not so different. To me, writing is acting. Except in a movie, it's just one person. You're just thinking of your part. There's the director, there's your co-stars, there's the producers and all that. When you're writing, as an actor, I play all the parts. I play the parts of the women, young people, old people. I play all the parts. I play the scene in my mind, and I say, Kirk, that was terrific, and I write it down.
Did you encourage Michael to be an actor? And can you share some ideas with us on your professional relationship with your son?
I thought Michael was going to become a lawyer. And I was pleased because I have four sons and I've always tried to push him out of my field. And suddenly in sophomore year, Michael said he's going to do a play. I said, a play? So I went up to the University of California, Santa Barbara, went up to see it. I'm sitting in the stage. It was Midsummer Night's Dream, and there were these kids in Shakespearean garb, and suddenly this fellow comes down the aisle with these tights, arms akimbo, I think is what they call it in the Shakespearean things, and he comes out on the stage, "For soul of those shall go." It was Michael. After it was over, he had about 10 lines. After it was over, he said, "Well, Dad, what do you think?" I said, "Michael, you were terrible." And I thought that would end his desire to be an actor. Not at all. In a month later, he was in another play. I went to see him. "What'd you think, Dad?" I said, "Michael, you were very good." And Michael's been very good in everything that I've seen since then. And I think he's a better actor than I am. I think he's a talented fellow. We're talking now for the last couple of years of finding a project that we will do together. And I hope within the next year or two, we will find something and we will work together, although I do it with trepidation because we're getting along very well now. I don't know what's going to happen.
Could you discuss your own production company and the choices you make and the type of films you would like to produce?
Well, my own production company, Bryna, I think I was one of the first actors to start his own production company. I named it Bryna after my mother. That was my mother. I taught my mother how to write that name, B-R-Y-N-A. And after I had the company, I took my mother in a big limousine down Broadway once night. I said, "Ma, see, in lights, your name, I taught you how to write it, B-R-Y-N-A, Bryna presents Spartacus." And my mother said, "Ah, America, such a wonderful land." In my company, you know, I only started a company to try to do some movies that I felt I wanted to make. You know, we made Spartacus, we made The Vikings, Paths of Glory, Lonely Are the Brave, 7 Days in May, made pictures that I was excited about making, and I enjoyed the process. It's too much work now. I wouldn't think of trying to do that now. And now my son Michael has his own production company, and I'm anxious to see what he does and what his choice is of the movies that he makes.
Job applicants often are asked in their interviews to list their favorite books or what periodicals they regularly read. For you, the question might be, which of your roles would you say was your best or favorite?
Well, you know, after 81 movies and I'm going into my 82nd, you know, you like different movies for different reasons. But it always seems to me when I'm thinking of that, that I come back to a little movie that I did called Lonely Are the Brave, which is a movie that I like very much.
Tell us a little bit about why you think that is your favorite movie.
Well, I guess one reason is, you know, I've played so many tough guys and villains and nasty characters. In Lonely Are the Brave, I was a beautiful guy. I was such a nice person. I thought, my gosh, it was a beautiful character. And he had expressed a wonderful philosophy, and I enjoyed making it. I think it's an important picture. I think it's a picture that kids in college now become sort of a cult film, and I think that's a film that I think will have a good influence on young people.
You have written that all you need to exercise is 15 minutes a day. What do you do in that time to keep so trim, vigorous, and virile?
Well, it's true. As a matter of fact, you know, they told me we don't huckster here, so I don't like to keep talking about Last Tango in Brooklyn. But the leading character of that novel is based on my gym instructor, who's in his 70s, and I've worked out with him over 25 years, 15 minutes a day. That is all you need to stay in good shape. Then in addition, you try to walk up some steps, you try to walk a little bit, and that's all you need to stay in condition. And I follow that, and I like it, and I think that most people, when they think of working out, they always think of working out hour and a half or something, and then they hurt themselves, then they don't work out for a week or so. But if you are consistent with 15 minutes a day, you will have enough to keep yourself in good shape.
This questioner says, Richard Gere was criticized for using the Academy Award form to make a political statement about human rights in China. What are your views regarding the actor's role in politics, and if you think Gere or the others were correct?
Well, you have to choose your arena. I think that the Academy Awards was not quite the arena to express his point of view as worthwhile as it is. And as I said before, I think that people in my profession have a responsibility because they have an advantage over to be able to be in contact with people in the media. Here I am talking to you. And I think they have to keep that in mind. But nevertheless, we're still Americans. We're still citizens. We have a point of view. We pay our taxes. And we like to participate in our government and voice our point of view.
This questioner says you were in a wonderful television film called Amos, which was an expose of the nursing home. Are you still involved in nursing home reform?
Yes, not to the extent that I was at that time. I was pleased that Amos was a film. See, and television does some wonderful things that is difficult to do in theatrical films, and that is you can deal a lot with subjects that I think are very important. I did a TV movie, The Secret, which dealt with dyslexia. And in Amos, which dealt with elderly abuse, I felt that I was in Washington at a meeting before the congressional investigation. I thought we helped to bring attention to some of those problems. We don't solve them, but we can help to bring attention to it.
Little Big League has just opened, a movie aimed at youngsters and their parents. Yet it is rated PG for having a scene in which a youngster views a soft porn flick. Do you think this is necessary for the for this movie to succeed, or is this something that should be kept out so this could have been a G movie?
I didn't see the movie, so I don't know how to make a comment on it. But let me tell you this. All forms of trying to designate what a film should go by is going to be, you know, a subjective point of view. Some people will agree and some people will disagree. All I think that the filmmaker has an obligation is to let the public know enough about what the film is about in order to guide whether or not you want your children to see the movie. As I said before, an adult, I mean, are we here to worry about the morals of adults? That's up to them. But the only responsibility we have is to let parents know what a movie's all about for them to make a decision whether or not they want their children to see it.
This questioner wants to know, why Brooklyn for your latest book? Why?
I love Brooklyn. I come from upstate New York. Years ago, I was doing a movie with Lorraine Day, who was married to Leo DeRocher, who was then managing the Dodgers in Brooklyn. And they brought me to Brooklyn to see a game. And a Brooklynite up in the stand yelled out to me, "Hey, Koik, how's Boyd?" And I love Brooklyn. And I wrote my novel because when I was 10 years old, someone brought me to Coney Island. And I went on the Thunderbolt, the biggest roller coaster in the world. I was so excited, I wet my pants. My God, I thought, this was wonderful. Now, when I went back and researched for the book, this is just a skeleton against the Manhattan skyline. And I can't believe it. I think, my God, the Thunderbolt is dead? You know, I couldn't believe it. So that's, you know, I have a lot of those emotional feelings about Brooklyn, and I express them in my novel, which I won't mention the name.
You can't appear at a press club and say that you read three newspapers without saying which three newspapers you read.
I don't mind. I'm the first one up. 6 o'clock, I'm the one that turns off the alarm. I'm the one that lets out Banshee, my dog, and I'm the one that goes out in the morning, and it's beautiful, and I pick up the Wall Street Journal, I pick up the New York Times, and I pick up the Los Angeles Times. That's all I have time to look at is I lie in bed and sip a cup of coffee, and I like reading the news, and I'm a big, you gotta be nice to me because I'm a big customer. I subscribe to three papers.
You were involved in fighting the blacklist in the 1950s. Do you think, can you tell us a little bit about what you did to overcome the McCarthyism of that time, and do you think all vestiges of this have disappeared, or are there new attempts at censoring people?
Well, you're referring to the McCarthy era, which a lot of you are too young to have been, you may know about it now, but been a part of. It was a terrible, terrible spot in American history. And at that time, anyone he thought was a communist, blacklisted. And the writer of Spartacus, his name was Dalton Trumbo. He was in jail for a year because of the McCarthy thing. When he came out, he was blacklisted. He had to write secretly. He had to be home. He had to write under an alias. And when he was writing Spartacus, he used the name Sam Jackson. And then I said, my production, I said, what name are we going to put on the screen? Well, you know, I don't know, we debated what kind of a name. And then I thought, Dalton Trumbo won an Oscar under another name, Robert Rich. And at the Oscar ceremony, they said, now the winner of the best writer is Robert Rich, who unfortunately cannot be with us. Everybody knew it was such hypocrisy, I was disgusted with it. So I said, hell with it. I'm going to put Dalton Trumbo on the screen. What can happen? And my agent said, oh, you're going to lose your career and all that. But I put his name on the thing. The sky didn't fall in, and the blacklist was broken.
We are about out of time, unfortunately, although this has been wonderful. We do have a certificate of appreciation for you appearing here, and the ever-popular National Press Club mug. Now, Elizabeth Taylor has one of these.
What the hell does he mean by that?
Just in case you wanted to get together.
I'll keep that in mind, and I thank all of you very much for giving me this chance to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Of course, one more question. That's all right.
Listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.